I'd rather have a country in which everyone is welcome. And you're not told, oh, you're second class because you're a Muslim or a Jew or not a member of the whatever alleged dominant religion is to be there. I want a pluralistic country. But national conservatism openly and explicitly rejects this.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Tom Palmer. Palmer is currently working at the Atlas Network and is also Executive Vice President for the International Program. And this is a podcast in our MPS series, where you will meet many lecturers who visited the MPS seminar in Oslo in October 2022. The title of his paper for this conference is Radical Illiberalism on the Right, the Reemergence of Central Themes of the Conservative Revolution. And in addition, I could mention that Tom's latest book is called Development with Dignity. First of all, welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you so much, Matilda. It's great to be with you and here in Oslo.
Good. I think we should start by defining populism, because populism is a word that we hear. It's a buzzword. We hear it all about. We can see it in the newspapers almost every day. But how should we define it, and how do you do it?
Well, looking at it as a political scientist, you have this problem. The more granular you become, the fewer countries or manifestations you can encompass. As you become more able to talk about populism in Turkey or Hungary or Norway or US or wherever, you end up with a thinner definition. So it's a kind of a challenge. Isaiah Berlin addressed this in 1967, a great paper on populism. He said, one thing you find that's common to all cases is the sense that the true or authentic people, that's a very important point, that the true people have been somehow victimized by an enemy, by an elite, by the Jews, by immigrants, by shadowy figures, somebody. And that a populist movement is to channel that sense of rage, that victimization against the enemy. And so a key theme in populist discourse is the distinction between the people and the enemies of the people. Ernesto Laclau, who was a populist theoretician, originally a Peronist and a Marxist and then a post-Marxist, but he was committed to destroying liberalism. That was his goal. He said that in his book on populist reason, that you have to generate an internal frontier of exclusion within the population so that the people doesn't count all the human beings in the society because the others are the enemies of the people. And you can then mobilize the people by hatred of the enemies. His wife, Chantal Mouffe, also a distinguished political theorist and a populist and follower of this train of thought, said, we create the people we want to build by designating the enemy. And so that's really the key. It is a ploy to seize power, to generate a movement of people based on resentment and anger and fear and rage, to oppose whatever the enemy is. And the choice of the enemy is up to the populist ideologue. Jews, foreigners, the bankers, who knows what. That doesn't matter to them. So that, I think, is the core of populism. And we see it all around the world, many different societies. And then there's some ancillary features as well that we could explore further.
Mm. Yeah, I remember as we talked about before we started this conversation on the podcast, Francis Fukuyama, and he also mentioned Isaiah Berlin, as you know, mm-hmm. for defining populism. And he also said something about the populist leader's position and how he or she is operating. Maybe you could say something about that.
Well, it's a very interesting point. And reading Ernesto Laclau's work, he was very much influenced by Carl Schmitt. And Schmitt was a German a juridical thinker, became, as they called him, the crown jurist of the Third Reich. He advocated and promoted dictatorship, destruction of liberal democracy, destruction of liberalism and all its manifestations, and then the foreign policy of the Third Reich and its annexationist, to use a contemporary word, foreign policy. And Schmitt distinguished between the friend and the enemy. Now, in Laclau, who writes in such a turgid, almost unreadable style, it's actually painful to read his books, because he really, I'm convinced, he didn't want to be immediately understood because his doctrine is so odious and disgusting that most people would recoil from it. He talks about the fundamental unit of political discourse is the demand, not a demand understood as economists understand it, namely a schedule of willingness to pay for quantities of goods. But the demand as a four-year-old understands it. Give me that. I want that. I want that now. That accumulation of demands, and they don't have to have any coherence. They don't have to be logically consistent, just demands. What is it that gives this totality a unity? And he talks in Lacanian terms, this kind of pseudo-linguistic approach, about an empty signifier. And when I read through this and trying to understand it, then looking at the examples, the empty signifier that generates the unity of this movement is Juan Perón. It's Mussolini. It's a strong man. It's a dictator. That is what creates this unity, not the unity or coherence of the demands. As liberals would say, you know, these have to be consistent free speech and consistent with the private property and the rule of law and so on. These all click together in a way. In populism, they don't. We want more stuff. We want to pay less for it and so on. But what unifies them is focus on the leader. And then the last point, this had a prefiguration in the 1920s and the 1930s. The so-called conservative revolutionaries who emerged after World War I in Germany were unable to come together on any program or platform. They squabbled and disagreed about everything. And what did happen, though, in the mid-20s, was a focus instead, what we need is a leader, ein Führer, ein Führertum, leadership. This would provide the unity of the conservative revolution. And by golly, they got one. Hmm. Sometimes not the one that these people had wanted, and a number of them were executed. Others became enthusiastic Hitlerites, some of them not. But they laid the ground by saying, well, we can't come up with a coherent program. So our program is to demand a leader who will then lead us and dictate to us.
Mm. And that's scary. So you talked about that, the conservative revolution, and you now mentioned Germany. And were there other countries and other examples that you have, if we go back like 100 years, 1920s?
Just to be a bit more provocative, we don't have to go back 100 years.
We can take a couple of years. More recent ones
so
later.
Let me give you two that are just at my fingertips. So Viktor Orban, who's the prime minister of Hungary, who's effectively created a one-party state in Hungary. As he said, we are building an illiberal state within the framework of the European Union, which I'll translate for other Europeans, means we will build an illiberal state at the expense of the taxpayers of Denmark and Germany and Spain and so on. That's exactly what that means, because they receive the highest per capita subsidy from the EU. So they reject principles of open society, but they do demand the money, which they continue to receive. Well, here's what he said on this question. He said, there's no policy-specific debates that are needed now. The alternatives in front of us are obvious. A famous speech he gave, he said, we need to understand that for rebuilding the economy, it is not theories that are needed. Theories is code word for discussion, but rather 30 robust lads who start working to implement what we all know needs to be done. This was in the context of his refusal to debate opposition political figures. He has had no debates with opposition leaders. He will not do it, he says. All we need is action. And then, of course, there's Donald Trump, everyone's favorite populist clown. But in his inaugural address, he warned us of what was to come. This was written by Steve Miller and Steve Bannon, who are two figures deeply immersed in these conservative, revolutionary, anti-liberal ideas. And let me quote briefly from the inaugural speech. He says, at the bedrock of our politics will be a total allegiance to the United States of America. A little chilling in an American context, total allegiance. And through our loyalty to our country, we will rediscover our loyalty to each other. The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action. So we don't need any more discussion, no more conversation, no more deliberation, no more open society. Act. Act for its own sake. This had a name in the 1920s and 30s, advocated by anti-liberal thinkers, and it was called decisionism. That rather than looking for the policies or the values that we can find to be valuable and then pursue those, we create value by our decisions. We decide it, and therefore our decision makes it true, and specifically the decision of the leader.
Yeah, and that's the point, because he or she is supposed to know exactly what the people wants.
Well, it's not that they divine what the people want by some sort of public opinion polling. It's that their decision means it is by definition what the people want. That was the idea, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. The one people, so all the German population, and then, of course, all the ones that they would annex and Germanize, which is the plan for Scandinavia, one empire over them, and then one leader for that entire population. And so it wasn't just that the leader is somehow wiser or smarter. I mean, that would be one point, but that would be debatable. Maybe so, maybe not. It is the leader decides what the people want, rather than the leader knows what the people want. And there's a difference between the two.
Absolutely, yes. And that's important because you could say where does he or she get his information from, and how are those decisions made? How is it to be believed? How can you and I, if we were in that situation, believe that those decisions were the ones that we wanted?
Well, that's why they specifically divorced it from the world of cause and effect, from the world of the Enlightenment. It was to be decided. The decision makes it true. And this is what we hear. This language comes out of Trump all the time and other strongmen of this sort. It is that their decision is to be followed because they are the people. Hugo Chavez also gave a speech, one of the most bizarre speeches I've ever seen. He said, I am not Chavez, I am a people. You are Chavez. And he says, Venezuelan woman, you are Chavez. Venezuelan farmer, you are Chavez. Because Chavez is not me, Chavez is a people. We've heard this language again. Think about Erdogan in Turkey, very famous point when he was challenged by an opposition member in the Turkish parliament. He said, who are you? We are the people. And he meant he, of course, with the plural, we are the people. Who are you? And so this notion that the leader really is the people is the core of this deeply illiberal, anti-democratic thinking. And it's very easy, particularly in times of crises, for people to say, well, if only we had a leader, the leader, the leader, the leader who will solve all of our problems, rather than all these boring parliamentary commissions and public debates and newspaper articles and radio talk shows where people disagree. Just get rid of that. And as Trump said, the time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action. And it's action for its own sake.
Let's just think about a little the 1920s, as we just discovered, talked about, and you have the crack, and you had a tough 1930s, and we ended up in World War II. What do you think are the main reasons that we see populist leaders, like you've just mentioned a couple of them, and there are others, why they are surfacing more up to the to the surface and even about now than, for instance, like 30 years ago, if that's true, because there has always been populist leaders, that's for sure. But right now, these past, since, let's say, Donald Trump and Viktor Orban, of course, but that, especially Donald Trump, that's not so many. It's like we are in 2022 and this wave of that populism started, let's say, about 5 to 10 years ago. Why is it now?
Well, this is a hard question.
I know.
But I think that there are some things we can say about it that help to explain the situation. And the first one is that, and Jonathan Haidt, who's a empirical psychologist, has addressed these questions. And Karen Stenner, and she is also empirical psychologist who does political science, that sometimes there are periods of rapid change in a society that create a feeling of being endangered. And certainly the United States experienced that. If you look at immigration rates, and by the way, I'm very pro-immigration, but I just want to look at the evidence of what impact it seems to have politically. They're the highest they've been since the 1920s. So a very high percentage of the American population right now was not born in the United States. And most people, that's not such a bad thing, but it seems to reach a certain level that people feel alienated from their society. There's such a rapid change. And of course, in Europe, the weaponization of refugees by the Putin government, this was very deliberate in Syria. They bombed schools, hospitals, residential areas, aid convoys, war crime on war crime on war crime. But the purpose was to drive these refugees into Europe in the hopes that it would destabilize. Of course, it made things pretty hard in Europe, and it really did accelerate the rise of these populist parties because of their anti-immigrant rhetoric and so on. So that's a part of it. The other thing is that such rapid change can bring about a psychological dynamic that we need to pay attention to. So as a kind of traditional classical liberal myself, I focused on the approach that the classical economist took, Jean-Baptiste Say, if you become better off, it's not bad for me. It's good for me that we don't have a zero-sum society where your gain has to come at my expense. We can all become richer, wealthier, more prosperous, healthier at the same time. If you live longer, it doesn't mean I have to have a shorter life. And that's very important because a lot of people don't get that. They think the world is zero-sum. It's not. It's positive sum also. However, when we think about social standing, that is to say, your position relative to others, if we were to rank people by popularity, for example, from 1 to 100, and somebody becomes more popular, the least popular person goes up a little bit, somebody else had to fall. So these relative rankings, which we haven't really focused on very much, they do matter in human psychology. And so if you look at the United States, for example, we celebrate that so many people have risen, women, their condition. They're not just homemakers or what have you. There are women CEOs and secretaries of state, presidential candidates, and so on. African Americans have certainly risen in status. The president of the United States was African American man. Immigrants, minorities, gay people are no longer driven into the corner. They can be out and open and not always portrayed as comical figures, and so on. Well, so if some groups are rising in this ranking, somebody has to fall. Who is falling? Well, it turns out it's a core demographic of Donald Trump, and that is to say Caucasian males who have not completed a university degree or college degree. Their status fell. Now, their incomes rose. They have much more income than their parents did, but their status fell, and they feel it. And now let's look at popular culture, I think, has accentuated that. In the United States, if you want to mock someone as stupid or dirty or undesirable, you wouldn't give the person a foreign accent, a Mexican accent. This would be very dangerous to your career. You wouldn't mock a person of color or Muslim and so on. Whom would you mock? A white person with a rural accent. You can make fun of them all you want. And it turns out they don't like that. In a lot of American popular culture, when people are portrayed as low intelligence, they give them a rural accent. And unsurprisingly, that causes a lot of resentment, this sense that people look down on us. And I'm with them in that. That is horrible. But it has had this consequence. So I think that looking at the changes in society, we've generated a group of people who feel that they have been left behind, not just economically, but that their status has been impinged on. And that's something we need to think more carefully about, how to develop a response to that that avoids this ugly populist backlash.
Because we could say that in the United States, the development of the right and the Republicans in the United States is also connected to this. And we don't know for the moment, because it's 2 years ahead, the presidential election, of course. But can you just give me your thoughts on the development of the right and the Republicans in the United States, continuing actually what you were just saying and how you see this will develop? Because as we know, the presidential election in the United States, it's not important only to the United States, but it's important for the world.
I think that there's been a major transformation among, let's say, American conservatives. They had been in the past a much more open, broadly part of liberal democracy, stalwart defenders of liberal democracy and the rule of law. If you think about someone like Ronald Reagan, and you agree or disagree on this issue, that issue, the other issue, these people were believers in liberal democracy. I would have to say that's no longer the case. Among many people, there's been a growth of what is called national conservatism in the United States. It's nationalistic in that regard. They believe in that the whole society should be somehow coordinated. You have figures such as Professor Hazzoni, Ram Hazzoni, who argues in his books on nationalism and conservatism, the United States is a Christian country and it is a Christian identity, and this should be clear. Well, it's a little bit rich coming from a non-Christian who's an Israeli citizen. And as a U.S. citizen, it's a little bit hard to push my nationalistic buttons. I'm generally tried to be a very tolerant, open person. But I don't like having an Israeli tell me that my country has to be a Christian country. I rather have a country in which everyone is welcome. And you're not told, oh, you're second class because you're a Muslim or a Jew or not a member of the whatever alleged dominant religion is to be there. I want a pluralistic country, but national conservatism openly and explicitly rejects this. It's motivated also by a kind of rage and resentment. They think that some mythical vision of what America is has been wiped away, and what they want to do is reconstitute something that didn't really exist, namely a Christian country. As opposed to a country with a First Amendment that guarantees that there'll be no restrictions on the pursuit of religion. You cannot establish a state church. It's illegal. I cannot imagine a more un-American thing than this national conservative mode. Now, related to this, though, is a demand for personal loyalty to the great leader, and this is Donald Trump. It is puzzling to me why grown women and men are afraid of him, but many of them are. I cannot understand being afraid of a man like that. But the political class within his own party, even people who think he's a clown and stupid, which there are many, they're afraid of him. And so he has now changed it from being the Republican Party, whatever their principles were, they had some, to being the Donald Trump Party. And that whatever Donald Trump says is the truth. With that as a background, I should mention, because it's a bit of an attack on what I see is happening among American conservatives, there were a few people who saved the American Republic from a civil war, and they were Republicans. They're people I often don't agree with, but I admired their fidelity to law. So the Vice President Mike Pence was threatened, not only cajoled and yelled at, but actually threatened with his life about this ceremonial role to refuse to certify the election. But he did what he was supposed to do. He did the minimum, but he did it when it was needed. And the secretaries of state of a number of states who are Republicans, who endorsed Donald Trump and voted for him, he said, we counted the votes and you lost. We have the recording of Donald Trump calling the Secretary of State of Georgia, Mr. Raffensperger, and I have to say I'm grateful to that man for having refused to be intimidated, even though he said, all I'm asking is you find exactly the number of votes I need to win. Find the votes. It was really quite clear. This was illegal. This call was illegal, and I'm glad that he recorded it. A small handful of people like that saved the Republic. However, Trump knows who they are, and he has been working to eliminate them one by one.
Do you think there is any candidate at all, apart from Trump, that might surface before the nominations for the next period, a presidential?
I wish I had a crystal ball. I don't.
Or do you think it's likely?
Well, if Mr. Trump runs, he's likely to get his party's nomination because it is his party now. Not in the way that it was a party of George Bush or Ronald Reagan or Dwight Eisenhower. It's his party in the sense that he's creating the Donald Trump party. And so I think he would be likely to get it. What we saw in the last election, because of his behavior, was the group that he lost that accounted for his defeat in these key battleground states, such as Georgia, was suburban Republicans who voted for him for the first time. And then the second time they said, I can't do this. And one of the reasons that gives the lie to the claim that the election was stolen was all of the vote counters in those counties are Republicans. The secretaries of state in those states were Republicans. It was the old Republican middle class people who said, no, I'm not going to do this again. And they did something, I think, for many of them that was very hard to do. They went and voted for the Democrat.
Yeah, I was going to ask what alternative is there now for them?
Well, fortunately for the Democratic Party, they nominated a person, and I'll be very frank, I think many of his policies are terrible. I'm not a big fan of Mr. Biden. But they nominated the least terrible Democrat who was running from the perspective of a moderate voter. And we'll see what happens next time around because the extremes on both parties are trying to pull their parties to nominate the most extreme candidate, would be Trump or whoever it might be on the Democratic side. And I'm quite worried about what, let's just say broadly, liberal centrist voters will do in that circumstance. So too early to say.
Let's just then go back or go up or go to the theory more of that we started with populism. But how does populists see democracy and where do you mean that they are wrong? And if we could talk about also how democracy is supposed to work as for in the liberal democracy understanding of the word. So how does it in these more, not in the United States, but in general?
As a general model, populists see themselves as the true Democrats because they represent the true people. They are the only spokespeople for the true people. This is, by the way, why they find it, and why Trump found it, impossible to understand that they might lose. We're the people. How can we possibly lose? It must have been rigged. Or the ones who voted against us, it was all Venezuelan and Chinese hacking and et cetera. So all these fables and stories from the United States. They can't imagine that the people didn't vote for them because they are the people. So that's the first point. They see themselves as the only true Democrats because for them, a democracy is about the will of the people, the true people. And the true people have one will because they are one people. Well, a liberal perspective understands that any group of people is going to be heterogeneous, that there's a lot of differences. We don't all like the same kind of candy. We don't all like the same sort of thing. We don't all want to drive the same car, whatever. Everything that distinguishes our relationship to God, how we choose to worship, and so on, that society is variegated, it's pluralistic. And this they cannot accept. There must be only one true way of life, only one true opinion. But liberalism is about living together with all of our differences and finding something that's common, and that is mutual respect for one another, mutual respect for the law. And the law doesn't tell me what color my car has to be or how I'm going to worship God, to go from something trivial to something profound. The law is about protecting us all in our equal rights, so that my neighbor who's Muslim and my neighbor who's Jewish, my neighbor who's Catholic, my neighbor who's a Lutheran, a Protestant like I was raised, we can all live together in the same society and in the same neighborhood. We go bowling and our kids go to school together. But then on the days of worship, we go to our separate houses of worship. And that's okay. So liberalism is about navigating all those differences and creating a minimalistic rule of law to allow us to live together peacefully and cooperate. The view of democracy held by the populace is, no, we're going to find the true, correct solution, which is going to be articulated by our leader, that is to be imposed on everyone.
And the majority is the majority, and those who lost, they are not supposed to be listened to.
Well, specifically, they're illegitimate. Mm. So they don't even think so much in majoritarian terms. They think in terms of the people and the enemy. And what is happening, and we're seeing this in a number of countries, is this notion that the opposition is fully illegitimate.
Even though they live within the same borders.
They're not us. They're the enemies. And so you hear this language about the enemies of the people and so on, or statements, as we've heard in a number of countries, that these people are not Poles, for instance, that government leaders have said of opposition figures. They're not Poles in Poland. These people are not Hungarians in Hungary, if they're on the other side of the political debate. And the important part of a free society is to say, well, of course you're a fellow Hungarian or Norwegian or American. We just disagree on these matters. But I don't say that you're a foreign agent, you're a foreign body, that you're a virus or a bacterium. And by the way, often accompanied with language that is deliberately dehumanizing to describe the opposition. So liberal pluralism is about being able to have multiple different ways of life within a society, and we tolerate them. And by the way, when I say we tolerate, I take that very seriously. If it's a question of same-gender marriage, we allow that in free societies. We don't demand that a church has to perform it if the members of the church don't want to do that. They have the right to their opinion as well. And they need to respect the equal rights. So if there's a same-gender couple down the street, they respect their rights. They need to be respectful of them. But if they don't want to perform that wedding in their church, that's their business to make that decision. We need to tolerate also people that have more traditional and conservative views. They're part of our societies also.
So I think you mentioned, I know that you said you spoke Russian, or at least understand Russian.
I would not say that by any means.
By any means. But you know a lot about Russia and the Soviet Union. And I think since we are in October 2022, we know that, there is a war going on in Europe. And usually what we have been talking about so far is actually, it's not a war, but it's profound differences within countries. I mean, populists on one side, and then people also living within the same country are not part of that if they don't agree. So, in the worst sense, that could be a civil war. I mean, that could be the result. How do you see Russia and Putin in your in these matters that you have been talking about? It's not populism, but there are other things in the Russian society that you might want to comment on.
The creation of a deeply criminal state in Russia, which we have seen, which was the bringing of the KGB into positions of power, along with oligarchs who often acquired their wealth by just plain old criminal means, has created a state that is effectively the personal property of a small number of people. There's no opposition. The opposition has been wiped out. The parties that at one time formed the majority in the Duma don't exist anymore. They have no representation. They were all destroyed. And I recall when this was happening, the control by Putin of the Ministry of Health meant that when leaflets had been produced, or what we call yard signs in America, little signs, vote for our party, you put in your front of your house or your window, the Ministry of Health would come down and seize them all for on health grounds to inspect them for bacteria. And they will be returned after the election. They seized all of the electronic equipment of opposition political parties and deliberately then allowed there to be two pseudo-opposition parties. This was a deliberate maneuver in the Communist Party, which is evil and crazy now. They're actually just authentically crazy. They've become an extreme Russian nationalist party. And the so-called Liberal Democratic Party, it was led by Zhirinovsky, who was an anti-Semitic kook. I mean, just bizarre. It's not liberal. It's not democratic. It was a completely crazy nationalist party. And so Putin, for many years, could then say, well, I'm the reasonable one. It's me or those guys? And a lot of Russians, even middle-class educated people, said, okay, if that's the choice, we'd rather have you than the lunatics, because he had destroyed all of the other liberal party, liberal and conservative and centrist parties were all wiped out. And now they've created this kind of nationalist ideal that is so reminiscent of the period leading up to and encompassing the Third Reich. It is astonishing the degree to which they are covering the same territory. This has been influenced by figures such as Alexander Dugin, who is a national socialist or Nazi philosopher in Russia. Very intelligent, by the way. We should never think that these figures are just street ruffians or gangsters. They use gangsters and street ruffians, but the leaders are often highly educated, very intelligent, multilingual people. Dugin is certainly one of those. But he openly calls for genocide, extermination of the enemies of Russia, the resurrection of the Russian Empire, and so on. And by the way, genocide, actually with that word, genocide against Ukrainians. And so this state that has been created is in my opinion, extremely dangerous. I'll tell you one quick story. When I began to get a feeling for what is happening in Russia, I was at a cocktail party for someone who had become a law partner, so had come to my party, and there was a Russian fellow there who was getting a little bit more drunk than the course of the party and speaking more freely. And what he said was a bit shocking. He said, well, people complained about the Soviet Union, but we had greatness, true greatness. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, oh, well, all these emigres, they complained about the lines and the shortages, but we had greatness. I said, what does that mean? And he got very upset and slammed the table. And then he said, with a very vulgar phrase, I won't repeat on this, but he says, the whole effing world was afraid of us. That was what he missed. Hmm. The world was afraid of them, and that wasn't true anymore.
That's what he wanted.
Yes, and this desire to have people fear you is now a dominant feature within Russian political discourse. Things are not good in Russia. Living standards are sliding, but people are afraid of us. And so I spent a lot of time in Ukraine in this year and delivering supplies and helping refugees to go out of the country, mainly moms and children, very elderly people, disabled people, and so on, and bringing in supplies. And the horror, the real genocide being visited on the Ukrainians, it is hard to describe what the Russian army has done. This is a horde, a looting horde. They rape, they steal everything they can, wedding rings. Now we found boxes of gold teeth pulled out of people, and their cars, their home appliances, their kitchen appliances, all stolen and taken back. They destroy everything. They torture people. In every town that's been liberated, they have found the same torture chambers with the telephone, which is an electrical torture device, installed. And they went to the point, as one soldier told me who was involved in the liberation of Irpin, they killed all their pets. They executed and dismembered their cats and dogs. Just to show, we exterminate you. You should all be afraid of us. And I think that we need, the world needs to take a stand against this and make sure that Russia is defeated, not destroyed. Defeated means all the Russian troops go back to Russia.
Yeah, and so far we see at least some advances on the Ukrainian side, but we're not there yet.
This may take a long time. Mr. Putin understands he can't afford to lose. There's a long history of this in Russia. The losers are deposed, and he knows he'll be killed by his friends. So he's like a really dangerous rat trapped in a corner. He might do anything. We don't know. So I think we should avoid excessive optimism, cheer on the Ukrainians. I'm very happy to see this liberation of territory and of people, but recognize that it may take some time before the Russian population gives up on this deeply malevolent dictator.
Finally, before we end the conversation, what do you think on a general and maybe specific level, if you want to talk about the United States, what do we do with right-wing populism as liberals?
Well, there are two points. There's also left-wing populism, so this is an important issue.
Well, let's say both.
So the Chavistas in Latin America are quite dangerous. Populism is an ideology that's a liberal, but it can pop up in different forms, left and right. I think that it needs to be openly exposed, and we need to make the case for living together with our neighbors. So there are a few things that I've been thinking about in this regard. One, it's kind of personal, and that is to say, to learn to listen to other people, to not dismiss them as stupid when they disagree with you, and to show respect to them. When populists, especially in this case, let's say the right-wing populists, are dismissed as stupid or mocked in this way, you know, this doesn't work. It just makes them more convinced because they really do believe that this other group hates them. And it's important to say, well, let me listen to what you have to say and really engage in conversation. And that's a bit of a one-to-one point. It's about our talking with family members and friends. And it's a little bit hard to do, but I think it's well worth it. Not mock people for their more conservative stances on life. As I mentioned, in the case of American popular culture, you want to make fun and mock people, show them as a rural white people, and you can say anything you want. They resent that, and I'm with them in understanding how they resent that, and we should be more tolerant in that regard. Then the other question that I've had discussions with people about in the European context is, well, what if they do get into power? What's the attitude, and so on? And there, I think, probably having to deal with political authority on the local level and make sure that the streets are cleaned up and the potholes are fixed and the trash is delivered or whatever it is a reality check on them. This isn't just a crusade against the enemy. You really have to deliver public services if you're running a local government. And at that level, I think that's probably a reasonable approach. At the national level, I'm more worried because you end up with the Orban-type situation where you get, once they're in power with a sufficient constitutional majority,
yeah, they can change.
They change all the rules so they can never be voted out again. And so I do fear them in this regard. But I think on the local level, the reality check and then seeing are they competent or not, this is what happened with the Five Star Movement in Italy. They ended up having to run a number of cities and they were incompetent. And people saw that and voted them out. I fear more at the national level if they can seize control of the national institutions of the state to cement their power, because there is a known playbook for doing that. Mm. Change the constitution so that the president can be reelected, et cetera. That's quite a clear playbook. And we have to be very careful not to allow them to do that.
Mm. Are there any countries in Europe that you would specifically follow?
Well, you know, I think that we should pay attention to what happened in Greece. Greece had a combination populist government of extreme leftists, the coalition of the radical left called Syriza, and the independent Greeks, PANEL, which was a far-right, nationalistic, pro-Orthodox party, both of which were connected to the Kremlin, by the way. That's another theme behind the funding of these movements all around the world. It's a lot of money from the Kremlin. But they were in power. It was a red-brown coalition, if you will. It was just so reminiscent of the 30s. But they were defeated by the New Democracy Party, which had formerly been in power years earlier. They had been involved in, frankly, bad governance in many ways. And a reformist wing cleaned out the old politicos who were rather corrupt and dirty. Had a clear agenda. They appealed to the people, and they defeated them. And they now have a committed liberal democratic government. It's in European terms a center-right government. Let's just say, broadly liberal and definitely democratic. So the populists can be defeated, and I think the Greece case is definitely worth studying, and it gives me hope that it is possible to have a more normal political dialogue and not to worry about having to choose between fascists and communists, which is a really horrific, terrifying choice. I'd rather have a center-right, center-left, centrist, farmers' party, all the sort of normal things we find in liberal democracies. So Greece is a country that gives me hope.
I think we should end on that, but I have to ask you, are there countries that we should worry about in the same context, also in the European, on the European side?
I think that there are concerns about the growth of parties such as Vox in Spain, who have a deeply illiberal approach. I think France is another one. The idea of a matchup between Le Pen and Mélenchon, this is to me quite a chilling possibility of I don't know how to describe Mélenchon, but the communist is somehow not strong enough. Mm. He's extreme radical figure. And then Le Pen, who's most people are better acquainted with her ultra-nationalism and protectionism and anti-market and the idea of French purity and so on. And the, let's just be very frank, racist background of this party. So France is one that concerns me when you think about the combined vote that the far left and the far right received in the last elections. It's really a majority. And so that is certainly a matter of some concern. We shouldn't take any of these countries for granted. I think that's really the takeaway. Mm. It's not just that there are some countries that, they were post-Soviet or they are post-communist or they didn't have a long tradition, blah, 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 blah. This can happen any place. And the example of the United States, I think, is a very good one. Mm. So many people told me, don't worry about the U.S. They have strong institutions. I said, well, fine. The institutions are only as strong as the ethics and the mores or the norms of the people who sit in those offices. And it was sorely tested. And basically, a small number of people saved the United States from a civil war. So you were just 15 or 20 people away from a civil war.
That makes it the future very, very scary if that's the case. Because
definitely,
if you say that those institutions might crumble if Trump comes back, then
well,
you'll
but
have
it's one. Also possible in any of the European countries that we're accustomed to, that attacks on the independence of the judiciary, parties that get in, and especially Poland is a very good example. Poland, I think, is going through a little bit of a realignment because of the fear of Russia. So the Polish government would have been very close to the Hungarian government. They broke with them. And the reason was that Mr. Orban felt the leash being yanked by his master in the Kremlin. And he is taking a pro-Kremlin line within NATO, by the way, quite disturbing. But Polish nationalists cannot be aligned with a Russian dictator because of their history. And they broke. And now I think there's a greater discussion in Poland. Well, what is it we want Poland to be? We don't want it to be like Russia, a dictatorship and a one-party state. And so that the idea of pluralism has been revived in Poland as
so
a consequence.
So one good thing comes out of this, do you think?
Well, I don't think a lot about silver linings, but I think that within Europe, the Kremlin invasion and genocide has presented the choice so starkly. I think it has reinvigorated authentic European liberalism because we see what is the alternative.
I can't let you go until I've asked you about Italy as well, because the elections in Italy just a couple of weeks ago elected Giorgia Meloni and her right-wing coalition. And she is together with two others, namely Berlusconi and Salvini.
It's such a puzzle to imagine that that Berlusconi might end up being the rational person in the room.
Yes.
But that seems to be the case when you compare to the alternatives. I think that of those three, authentically the most dangerous is Salvini, who is a, they say in German, a Putin-Freund, without any question. He worships Vladimir Putin, all the T-shirts and it's astonishing. And I find him much more dangerous. In a sense, Berlusconi seems, again, to be more the grown-up in the room, which, again, is sort of, I couldn't have imagined that a few years ago, but here we are. I have Italian friends who are serious analysts who have said, well, there's the election campaign and then there's the governance question. And they say, we're not happy with this outcome, but we don't think it's as scary as it appears, given the rhetoric. I hope that they're right. The one that I do consider more frightening of those three is Salvini, because I think he really is focused on destruction of liberal democracy. Not so obviously the case for the other two.
And well, you could say fortunately that that Meloni's party, Fratelli d'Italia, they got lots of more votes than Salvini's party, Lega Nord. So that's
right.
At least a small hope. Finally, book plans. I mentioned your last book, and you told me before we started that you might have another book coming.
A co-author and I, so Brian Chang from King's College, London, and I will be very clear, he did most of the heavy lifting on this book, but it's another book on development economics, which is bottom-up development. And it's been just such a pleasure working with him on this book. And that's been submitted to the publisher for review, and we're expecting to get back lots and lots of suggestions and changes, and we hope that'll be out next year. And then the other one that I think will grow out of this paper I've delivered here in Oslo on the re-emergence of these ideas, we call them conservative revolution, fascist, whatever we want to call them, ideas that came out of the 20s and 30s. It's been a lot of work because translating lots of German text into English gives me a headache at times. But I think it's important to see the reemergence of these same ideas. And so that's my next big project.
Well, thank you very much for taking your time today, Tom. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
And if you like Liberal Halvtime, rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Yeah.